Dan, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
Yes.
Please face the flag, put your hand on your heart, and recite with me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Yes, Chairperson Benz.
Present.
Vice Chairperson Ward.
He's excused absence, illness.
Commissioner Colomarino. Chairperson Benz.
Yes. This is the time for public comment. This is the portion of the meeting that is reserved for persons wishing to address the commission on any matter not on this agenda and over which the commission has jurisdiction. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes. Please state your name and address for the record before making your presentation. The commission may take action to direct the staff to place a matter of business on a future agenda. Does anyone in the audience wish to speak to the commission tonight about any matter that's within our jurisdiction but not on the agenda tonight? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment period and go on to the Planning Commission business. Could I have a motion for the consent calendar, please?
I move that we approve the consent calendar.
Do I have a second?
I second.
Been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Commissioner Colomarino?
Yes.
Commissioner Cooper?
Yes.
Commissioner Drez?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Chairperson Benz?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Okay, we next item is for the annual housing element progress report. Staff?
Good evening, Chairperson Benz and fellow gentlemen of the Planning Commission. Tonight, I'm presenting to you PLN 2006-1133, the annual housing reports. The recommendation for this report is that Planning Commission recommend to the City Council's submittal of the 2010 housing element annual report. The state requires that all cities to file an annual housing report progress by April of 2011. The purpose is to monitor the implementation of the general plan. As you know, the housing element is one of the mandatory elements as required in general plan by the state. This report reviews the progress toward meeting the city's regional regional housing needs allocation, or RENA. So what is RENA? It is the regional housing needs allocation and is distributed by SLOCOG for each municipality in the county. It is also the basis for assuring adequate sites and zoning is available for affordable housing. RENA basically are allocations, they're not quota. So we just have to ensure as a city that we have the adequate sites and zoning available for affordable housing to be built. And also we must reduce the obstacles to the implementation of seeing that affordable housing be built in the city. The Atascadero 2007-2014 RENA allocation is shown there in this table. The city's target is 462 units to be constructed for the reporting year of 2007 through 2014. The total income, the total target's broken down into four income categories, and that's very low, low, moderate, and above moderate. These income categories are established by the state for each county by the Department of Housing and Community Development. Affordability is based on income and household size. As you see below, the state defines very low income as 50% of the county median, lower income 80% of the county median, moderate income at 120% of the county median, and above moderate is anything any income above 120%. For 2010, San Luis Obispo income limits were established by the state in April. 50% of the county median is 36,250 and under. 80% of the county median is 58,650. December 31st, 2010, the city has met 38% of its total housing targets based on RENA. Of those, we've constructed or we've issued permits for 10 moderate income units, 9 low income units, and 8 very low income units. So it is, again, as we stated in October, it's a very good start for the city meeting its 2014 targets as established by SLOCOG. Again, this sort of chart right here breaks down by the years from 2007, 2008, 2010. Where we are at in terms of meeting our RENA numbers. For the very low, we about have 98 units left. For low, we have 65 units left. For moderate, 78 units left. Above moderate, 44. And so we have approximately 285 units to hopefully complete as a part of our target in 2014 to meet our total target of 462 units. So in 2010, we did see an increase in housing production over 2009. It was a 30% increase. Yes, we did issue only eight in 2009, but we issued 13 in 2010, so that is an increase. And the city, but however, the city did see a continued lack of demand for new housing units. The primary reason for that is foreclosures continue to dominate the market. Foreclosures, short sales, and as such, as a lot of these homeowners that have gone upside down, walked away, or simply just put their housing on the market to do a short sale. A lot of the home buyers right now are basically gobbling up those units that are on the market. Of the 13 housing units that permits were issued for 2010, we did issue two very low income rental units that were produced by the RDA as part of the downtown housing stimulus. The RDA in 2009 approved $500,000, and it was the program includes $100,000 per unit loan, and they allocated approximately five units to be a part of this loan, and there are three more units that are available under this program. As a part of this program, it's a 55-year loan to the property owner, and in return, we ask for a 55-year deed restriction on the unit. So even though these tough times for the RDA, as the state wants to raid the RDA and get rid of it completely, the RDA is doing very positive things in the city, including providing that affordable housing stock. Some of the bright spots in the 2010 housing production is that the median home price in Atascadero continued to increase from its bottom back in 2008. There is an increase in housing production comparative to 2009, and projects that went into foreclosure are being picked up. Those projects include Regio, Oak Grove Phase 2 is, I believe, currently about to be picked up. The villas at Montecito went into foreclosure, was also picked up, and has begun to move forward. Dove Creek is another larger project that is moving forward. So these larger projects that have sort of been sitting on the shelf since about 2007, 2008, are being picked up by developers and starting to move forward since the entitlements are pretty much done. That's a really positive sign in the housing market that the demand is starting to turn to produce these units. The moderate income group has the ability to own a home. That's another great positive spot about the 2010 housing production numbers. Again, similar to what we had in 2009, it's the first time this has occurred in many years in this region that people in the moderate income group have that ability to go ahead and get a loan if they have really good credit and go ahead and buy their first home. Again, another thing helping homeowners is you hear from every single real estate agent or mortgage broker out there is the interest rates are very low. So these low interest rates are really helping those homeowners who have the objection period. They have been issued before, or if they've already been deed restricted, those have already been previously allocated. So some of them will technically not count for this 2007-2014 reporting period, but nonetheless, they have been counted, and they're helping to provide additional affordable housing for the city. In addition, in January, the RDA committed approximately $5.5 million for the construction of 24 affordable housing units in the city. And with that, are there any questions?
Any questions from any commissioners? Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, Alfredo. And I don't know if you have the answer to this. How does the county establish what the moderate income is? And have you seen fluctuations in that, great fluctuations in that?
The county actually doesn't establish the moderate income. The income brackets are actually established by the state housing and community development. And the actual increase from 2009 and 2010 was actually only $500. So my assumption and from my understanding, the way HCD comes up with numbers, it works very diligently with the Department of Finance to come up with those numbers and those statistics.
Are there, I always thought that the county had provided the number. What the state provide, is it broken into regions or by county? I mean, are there different numbers for Monterey than Los Angeles?
The state breaks the figures down by county. So there are, each county is different, so each county has a different threshold in terms of very low, low, moderate, because it is broken down by essentially, or county is essentially sometimes a region. And then there have been other instances, even within San Luis Obispo County in the past, where they've broken down the affordability index by coast versus inland. I know that was done in the previous RENA allocation.
Maybe if I could just jump in real quick, Commissioner Schmidt. Mm-hmm. We do have a form that's produced by the county. So what the county does, they have a housing staff. So they take the numbers that they get from Department of Finance, and they take some calculations based on interest rates, and then they do have a printout, and we use that as part of our affordable housing. But in terms of the numbers that are in there, like Alfredo said, it's kind of a compilation of numbers that they're getting from other places to arrive at what those affordable rents and sale prices would be. But we do reference the county numbers, but those county numbers are based on state statistics.
And then does the is there a new level established each month? Or?
Yeah, the county prints something out. They issue it every month because the interest rates tend to be the biggest fluctuating factor that affects the sales price. Mm-hmm. So they do tend to adjust slightly based on interest rates on a monthly basis. And I think annually the county income is adjusted as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Thank you both.
Any other questions from commissioners? Hearing none. Could I have a motion? Anyone from the audience wishes to address this? Hearing none.
Commissioner Drez?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Chairperson Benz?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
Okay, we'll go on to public hearings. And prior to a project hearing, the Planning Commission members must disclose any communications that they've had on any quasi-judicial agenda item. So now is the time for disclosure of ex parte communications. We'll start to my right.
Yes, I emailed Alfredo this morning, and I had some questions about the signage on the project and some other things, and he clarified the questions. I wasn't aware of that there was a lot of work that had already been accomplished on the site, and that this although there are many conditions within the report, that a lot of them already had been completed. And one of the large questions about signage had to do with the property is along the freeway frontage. And so I was wondering if the applicants wanted to put up any type of freeway signs, what could be done? And that's the extent of the conversation.
Commissioner Garris?
I had no communication with staff or owners or agents or anything, but I did drive by the property just to observe what had been done in comparison to what was in the report. And that's the extent.
I have no ex parte communications.
I had no ex parte at this time.
None.
Okay. With that, we're open up the public hearing for the amendment to conditional use permit 2001-0043 for 2850 El Camino Real, and we'll hear from staff.
Thank you, Chairperson Bentz. As stated, this is PLN 2011-1392, CUP 2001-0043. The amendment to an existing CUP to allow a manufactured home sales lot. The existing site is approximately 1.57 acres. The CUP, as referenced 2001-0043, was approved in 2003. As a part of that approval, 30,250 square feet of mini storage was approved, along with 4,000 square foot of office uses and an 80-foot monopine cell tower. In 2006, a CUP amendment for additional antennas at the existing cell tower was also approved by the Planning Commission. If you were to break down the project currently in phases, the phase one improvements are complete, and this includes grading, landscaping, and the cell phone tower on site. Again, the project is located at 2850 El Camino Real. To the south of it is Highway 101. To the north of it is residential suburban, and surrounding it both sides on the east and west are the commercial park designations. This is an aerial photograph of the site. As you can see, the red circle on the screen, that is the existing 80-foot monopine cell phone tower. and the existing landscaping is shown in green. The landscaping is currently in place on both along the frontages of El Camino Real, as well as the rear of the property along Highway 101. The site has been graded, and as I stated, the existing landscaping is in place consistent with the approved CUP. The public improvements that are completed so far have been the curb, gutter, and sidewalk, along with the drainage inlets and the sewer laterals that connect to the neighboring Michael Frederick's paving. Take a look at the manufactured homes, could essentially take one of these display models home. It is the applicant's intent to sort of change out the display models every now and again. So they are considered temporary at this point. In addition, there's an additional landscaping area near the parking area that is consistent with the municipal code. This landscaping will consist of shrubs and trees and is consistent with our landscaping requirements. As part of this proposal, the applicant is proposing a sales office that is approximately 720 square feet. The sales office will be a manufactured home. An ADA accessible ramp will be constructed. The staff considers this the permanent structure of the site, so this will require a building permit. And the sales office will also need some architectural details to meet the city's appearance review manual. So this is an image of the potential sales office. And so this is a conceptual sketch of some of the improvements that would be necessary for the sales office. So those would include awnings along the windows and doors, 360-degree skirting, so that it sort of hides the foundation system that would be in place, and then additional landscaping to screen sort of the AC unit, and additional landscaping to sort of help beautify the sales office around the entire office. The applicant is proposing, as stated, the applicant is proposing a maximum of 4 sales units at any given time, and these units are located at the southern portion of the site. The applicant's also proposing a 58-square-foot monument sign. This monument sign is to be located along El Camino Real, and at this point will not require an AUP. The monument sign itself is consistent with the monument signage language that is within the Atascadero Municipal Code. The proposed amendment would replace the ability to construct the mini-storage at this time. So as I stated before, property owner has done the phase one improvements. Those phase one improvements are allowing the cell phone tower to be built. They put in the public improvements and the landscaping. Phase two of the project would have involved constructing the office and mini storage uses. So this sort of comes to bring up a quandary because the applicant at this point is not the owner of the property. Michael Frederick is the owner of the property of Michael Frederick Paving. If the manufactured home use leaves the site in the future, the ability to develop the property still exists because at this point the applicant is proposing to maintain many of the features that are on site today, including the existing gravel, the drainage inlets, and really the only improvements that it will be doing on site is adding the trash enclosures that are necessary, that are included in the conditions, the additional landscaping in the parking area, and the additional paving at the entry of El Camino Real. So the Planning Commission must make a decision on how to move forward with the potential future effects on the previously approved uses. Again, this is sort of looking into the future, knowing that we have two things. One is that the applicant is leasing the property, and two, if something were to happen, let's say 10, 15, 20 years down the road, I don't want to jinx the thing, if it gets approved, there remains that possibility that the property owner could potentially move forward with building what was originally intended, which was the mini storage and the office use. So staff has presented the Planning Commission with three options tonight. The first option is cancel all unbuilt CUP entitlements. Essentially what would happen is if the Planning Commission were to approve the amendment to allow the manufactured home sale site or home sales on site, this amendment will null all future phases of construction. So a new CUP would be required for any new proposed uses. This includes if the property owner comes back and wants to restart up the mini storage and or offices. Now, one of the main advantages to this is that we would essentially get to start from scratch over again as a staff. So that means that since 2003, the world has really changed along El Camino Real, and we really do have a lot of reasonable and foreseeable projects that are going on along El Camino route, and chiefly the Walmart would be considered one of those reasonable and foreseeable projects. Whether or not that affects this project, we do not know. But any new any new proposed uses would have to go through a new CEQA process in order to satisfy that component of state law. Option number two is to cancel the mini storage and extend the offices. So the way things are laid out today, essentially on the site plan, the mini storage is basically consumed by where the proposed model homes are. But essentially there's enough area left over to do the offices. So conceivably, the property owner could move forward with the offices to be built on site due to the configuration of the manufactured home sales. However, the property owner would have to, or any additional applicant, would need to meet the parking standards that the offices may make. So we've already approved 4,000 square feet of office uses on site. And again, conceivably, the way this thing is configured, as proposed by the applicant, additional offices may be built as long as they can meet the parking requirements. So option number two would cancel the mini storage, but extend the office uses to be, if they were to come in, let's just say tomorrow, with a proposal to do the office buildings on site. And finally, option number three is just extend all previous entitlements. So all previously approved uses will remain valid. Any future phases would have to be consistent with the approved CUP. So with option number three, if you approve the manufactured home sales amendment tonight, and let's just say again, 5-10 years down the road, the applicant finds a new site in town, or their business expands and they need to go somewhere else, or their lease simply expires, the property owner does have the ability to go back and construct the mini storage and the offices per the previously approved CUP 2001-0043. So this sort of illustrates what I've been discussing in terms of phase one and phase two. So phase one is the cell phone tower that is existing today on site. That cell phone tower is the giant pine tree looking thing. I can't even tell it's a cell phone tower. That's how good it looks, in my opinion. Phase two is the sales lot. This is what staff is considering phase two. So as you can see, the southern portion of the site would consist of the model homes for sale. This area right here would be the offices and then park, or it would be the office and parking site. So that's what we're considering right now as phase two, is this amendment. Phase three could be conceivably the office buildings. Because as I stated before, the office buildings could conceivably be built. This office building near the entrance of El Camino Real, the second one near the eastern entrance of El Camino Real. And again, phase four would be the mini storage use if the manufactured sales home lot does disappear in the very, very far future. As a part of this staff report, we do have conditions of approval changes. As a part of any conditional use permit, we do have a standard set of standard engineering conditions. The staff report, we basically omit some of the public improvements because they're already completed. So the existing CUP, that's 2001-0043, already contained a list of standard engineering conditions that either have been met or still need to be met. So we as staff feel that we can basically remove conditions 21 through 35 as a part of this approval. And those are the new set of conditions of approval, if this makes sense. So if you were to read your staff report, you'll see a new set of conditions of approval. Those conditions that are 21 through 35 can basically be removed because they are covered by condition number 6. And condition number 6 simply just states that all previous project condition approvals in CUP 2001-0043 are still in place. So with that being said, conditions 21 through 35, staff feels, can be removed. The Planning Commission does need to make five findings in order to approve this amendment to the conditional use permit, the first being that the proposed use is consistent with the general plan and the city's appearance review manual. The second, that the proposed project satisfies all applicable provisions of the zoning ordinance. And the third one is establishment and subsequent operation of conduct of use will not, because of the circumstances and condition applied in a particular place, be determined to be detrimental to the health, safety, and welfare of the general public. The fourth is that the proposed project will not be inconsistent with the character or immediate neighborhood. And the fifth is the proposed use will not generate a volume of traffic beyond the safe capacity of all roads providing access to the project. The Planning Commission does have three alternatives tonight. The first one is that the Commission may recommend additional modifications to the project and or additional conditions of approval to the project. Number two is that the Commission may determine that there is more information needed. If that's the case, the Commission should clearly state the type of information that is required and move to continue the item to a future date. The third is that the commission may deny the permit, and the commission should specify the reasons for denial of the project and make any associated findings with such action. Staff recommends that the Planning Commission approve PC 2011-002, approving PLN 2011-1392, an amendment to CUP 2001-0043 to allow for a manufactured home sales lot subject to conditions of approval and the following modifications, which is remove conditions number 21 through 35 as recommended by staff. And with that, I will open it to questions from the Planning Commission.
Any members of the commission wish? Commissioner Schmidt?
And as far as the alternatives with respect to the continuing the existing CUP, the recommendations by staff on that and those one of those three alternatives?
Are you asking whether
if staff has a recommendation on items 1, 2, or 3?
No, staff does not have a recommendation. We feel all options are very viable at this time. So.
As far as the existing office building, there were some modifications that were made to it that you noted that needed to comply with our appearance review manual. We have a design review committee that has been set up. Was that used in this process?
The design review committee was not used in this process. The applicant had come to us early on, and so we've been working with the applicant since November of 2010 prior to the DRC being established.
I'm wondering, and depending on what direction we go, as far as the continuing of the uses, the options that are provided, that could the design review committee be an avenue to allow for the extension of the current entitlements, and then for whatever reason, if there are the offices or things that are being proposed that are permanent construction, could that be brought through the design review committee to have some oversight?
You definitely could condition that. Kind of leaves the issue a little open, though, because right now they do have an entitlement for a building that's already in the plan. If you wanted to subject to a future design review, I think staff would recommend that you'd have very specific items that you'd be asking the DRC in the future to look for so that it was at least clear, what the range of what DRC's review would be, whether it was colors or materials or something like that, that you'd be looking for them to look at.
In that the continuing and extending of the entitlements could extend for, could for a long time or could be short time, depending on how things work with the business. Is there concern that, let's say if it goes 10 years, that there could be some substantial or changes that occur within the code that would not be applicable to this project because of the carrying of the entitlement?
Well, I don't think it's going to be necessarily a code change. The building's going to have to be built to whatever the building code requirement is. I think there could be changes in community preferences and expectations for development. So a metal-sided mini storage, while that's what was approved in the past, may not be that desirable in the future. I guess that would be the question, is if you leave it too open-ended, they could potentially not be able to get through DRC because the changes would be so significant, and then you might run into a problem where you have a CUP, but you can't get through design review, and that could be kind of an inconsistency. So that's where I think you'd want to make it very specific about what DRC would be charged with, just so they didn't have a blank check and decide that they wanted it totally redesigned to the point where it was no longer feasible or inconsistent with the original CUP site plan.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other commissioner questions of staff? Commissioner Colin Moreno.
Yes. I just want to make it clear in our minds and on the record what exactly we're being asked to do here. There is now a conditional use permit covering this parcel. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. The conditional use permit allows for the building and construction of the cell phone tower that has been fully constructed today. Originally permitted to have six antennas, amended in 2006 to have 12 antennas. The original CUP also permitted the construction of a 30,000 square foot mini storage, as well as up to 4,000 square feet of offices on site.
And what we're proposing to do now, or what we're being asked to do, is not to put another conditional use permit on the same parcel, but rather to amend the existing conditional use permit. Is that correct?
That is correct. It is to amend the existing CUP 2001-0043 to allow for the manufactured home sales use on the property.
Now, you can't have more than one conditional use permit on a parcel at any given time. Is that true?
Yes, our policy is one CUP on the site, because otherwise you'd have a consistency issue.
And once a conditional use permit is granted, how long does it last? What is its duration?
Typically under our code, it's 2 years. But once, if it's a phase CUP, which this is a phase CUP, our policy is once you complete the first phase, then the subsequent phases extend indefinitely, which is what the case is right now, that this mini storage entitlement, which is phase two, will run because they've already completed phase one.
I see. All right. So then the other thing I wanted to clarify is the applicant for this conditional use permit is the lessee, or is it the owner of the parcel?
The applicant is the leasee. The owner is Michael Fredericks Paving, or Michael Fredericks, excuse me, and he has signed off on the leasee to use the site.
And has the applicant, and I guess I should also ask, has the owner weighed in on what they want with respect to continuing the conditional use permits, allowance for them to build a mini storage unit or offices? Have we heard anything from them on that? Have you heard anything from them on that?
When we met originally, when this application came in with Mr. Fredericks, he expressed a desire for number three, which is to keep the mini storage and office entitlements intact.
And then the concern which I heard expressed by the staff is that if we keep those entitlements intact down the road, maybe 10 years or more down the road, we could end up with mini storage being built in a place where the neighborhood could have changed. In fact, we can foresee that it's changing, and that it might not be considered a suitable use or consistent with the neighborhood in the way that it was considered that 10 or 8 years ago, whatever it was, when this was first approved, or even now.
Yes, that's correct.
But in spite of that concern that you expressed, you're not taking a position with respect to either any of these three options.
Yeah, that is correct.
And one last thing on this is, as I understood it, it would be possible now for them to, when I say them, the lessee and the owner or whatever, to put this manufactured home sales business in the place that they intend to put it and their office, and also to build the offices that were originally allowed under the conditional use permit that was granted in 2001?
Conceivably, yes. Depending on the size of the office, depending on the size of the office building, it could potentially work. But then it would run into some design issues in terms of where to place parking with the sales lot, how to mesh the two together, potential storm drain issues as well as potential issues in terms of sewer. Is there enough capacity in the existing pipes that were put in to support those? So that those could be potential issues. So conceivably, those would need to be worked out. But yes, the way that it's designed today, the way that it has been set up as proposed by the applicant, you could potentially put in the office buildings.
Yeah, it's 4,000 square feet of office buildings were allowed in the original conditional use permit, and I assume that the offices for the manufactured home business would have to come out of that 4,000 square feet, and then you could put in the rest of the the rest of the office space allowed in the area that is not being used by the manufactured home sales operation, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Any other questions? Commissioner Derez?
Thank you. With respect to option two, I just wanted some clarification. If the business should leave in whatever amount of time, whether however many years, is the amount of office space still limited to 4,000 square feet, or is it whatever square footage you can fit and still accommodate the appropriate number of parking?
It is limited to 4,000 square feet because that is the amount that was studied as a part of the mitigated negative declaration that was adopted by the Planning Commission in 2003. So any additional square footage could be proposed, however, that would require an amendment to the CUP, as well as any additional CEQA review in order to satisfy CEQA would need to be completed as well.
Any more questions before I open up the public hearing? Yes, Commissioner Colomarino.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on the CEQA point. You've mentioned that. You mentioned it in the staff report. You mentioned it a couple times tonight. With respect to the original CUP, was there a CEQA finding?
Yes, there was a mitigated negative declaration that was adopted by the Planning Commission as a part of the original CUP. So as a part of our conditions of approval number 6, the mitigation monitoring measures that were included also pertain to this project as well. Since this project is proposing a significantly less amount of building square footage as comparative to the mini storage and office uses that were originally proposed, staff has found that this use would be consistent with the adopted mitigation mitigated neg deck.
So the original mitigated neg deck would continue to apply to the amended CUP that you're asking us to approve.
That is correct.
But down the road, if we went with, let's say, option two, there would have to be another CEQA finding. That's not clear. Why wouldn't it continue to apply?
Well, if the question by the commissioner was if they wanted additional square footage that had not been examined.
I see.
And so anything in addition to begins to trigger, in the eyes of CEQA, an additional review. And so it's adding on something that may not have been foreseen at the time. So you would want to, in order to, you know, for the city to be faithful to the law, you want to be able to review that per CEQA.
And, you know, you'd mentioned that the area that we're talking about is subject to change in the years ahead, particularly with what's happening at the Del Rio intersection, the developments there. Do you foresee that might result in a different CEQA finding down the road?
I do not know.
There could be traffic-related considerations that are a little different, I take it, in 10 years than there are now.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to open up the public hearing and invite the applicant and applicant's representative to make any comments. Members of the public will be invited to provide testimony to the commission following the applicant. Speakers should state their name and address for the record and can address the commission for 3 minutes. The applicant has unlimited time.
Good evening. My name is David Durant, and I'm here to represent Macy Homes. Macy Homes is a family-owned business. My father and I purchased it from the Macy family back in 94. It's actually the oldest manufactured home dealership in the state of California, established in 1951. We've been down in Ventura County all those years, and we've sold a few homes up in this area, but felt it was a good time right now to expand the business. We're very excited about coming to Atascadero. We feel there's a lot of opportunity here, a lot of private property, a lot of mobile home parks that need to have their old homes changed out. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them for you. I'd like to bring Eric up, who might want to address a couple of questions that we have, but I'm just, once again, excited to be coming up here. I think it's a great opportunity. What's exciting is, of course, the freeway visibility, which is always nice in our industry. As you can see, the houses, well, that's not one. Our houses have really come a long way in the last few years. Good percentage of it now is on private property. But they're same construction as conventional housing. We feel it's better because it has to travel down the road at 60 miles an hour, where I don't know if you want to do that with most conventional housing. But anyway, I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Commissioner Darius.
In the report, it indicated that you would that stock would be rotated occasionally,
yes,
based on sales and whatnot. What is the projection on the amount of units would be sold and possibly changed out on property?
Well, I'm hopeful of doing about two a month right now in this market. In Ventura, we're doing about two or three a month at the time, at the moment. I may be shocked up here and do four a month. I don't know. I'm hopeful. It's hard to say, you know. But yeah, that's about what I'm figuring.
Are there any presentations by any one of your representatives that wishes to speak before the commission?
Sure.
David, have a question for him?
Oh, just one second. We have a question from Commissioner Colomarino.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, do you have any projected revenue numbers that you're working with for the next couple of years, for example? Just to get an idea of what kind of sales tax revenues the city might be in for the result of this business coming here?
Yeah, the average home price is a complete project. Most of them, they're averaging about $140,000, $150,000. So, you know, if you do a couple a month. We also do a lot of resales where we actually go in a mobile home park and list and sell the homes, somewhat like a real estate company. We, in this market, would probably do two or three of those a month.
So you're talking maybe $400,000 a year?
Yeah.
Revenues?
Yeah. When things turn on, we definitely do closer to $1 million when yeah, things are moving. But yeah.
Now, may I ask also, I was involved in construction when I lived back on the East Coast, involving some manufactured housing, and there are a lot of large houses being built in factories.
Yeah.
There, 10,000 square foot homes, for example. And I know I was involved in the building of one that was about 2,200 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
Are you dealing at all with that kind of?
Oh yeah,
you are.
Private property up here, I feel, will probably do quite a few. What we call a triple wide, which is 2,000 plus square feet. We do some that are four sections. In this type of area, I would expect to do a lot of private property, big homes, 2,000 plus square feet.
And are you doing two-story also?
Yeah, we do a few of them. The problem, two stories were designed for very narrow lots. It doesn't make sense if you have a ranch to put a two-story on at the expense, the craning. It doesn't really pencil out. But we've done a few in some parks, but you know, gosh, in the last 15 years, I don't know if I've done more than four or five of them.
Because I know with the advent of computer-assisted design and the possibilities with that, there's been a surge in interest in manufactured housing,
mm-hmm,
certainly in the eastern part of the United States. And I know some engineering friends of mine have said that they think that you can get superior quality because the quality control in a factory is usually better than what it's going to be out in the field. And then, as you said, you have to manufacture these things so they're able to be carried, transported on roads, and then they have to meet standards, the highest, the most rigorous standards of any state, so that you end up with a product that can be superior and less expensive.
That's right. And it's quick. It's a quick process. It isn't, you know, of course, we go through the same permit process as conventional housing, but the project is quite quick. And the factory times maybe 4 to 5 weeks, and then once it's on the site, if everything falls into place, we don't have weather problems, it's done in 6 to 8 weeks. So it's a quick process.
And has your business been growing in recent years?
Oh, we just, yeah, a lot. It's gone crazy until, of course, the last couple of years. Right. Most of our business is a lot of seniors, a lot of retirees. They want to come to the coast. You know, here I understand they come from Fresno and Bakersfield down in Ventura. They come from Los Angeles, and a lot of it's cash deals. It's their final home. But the family business has been a little quieter, but we're doing all right.
Thank you.
The chair recognizes Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes. My understanding of the contractual process of this, and Commissioner Colmenarino had asked about leading into sales taxes. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, that the sales taxes basically go to the agency where the contract is mm-hmm. is signed, mm-hmm. and so you have other offices. Is there any chance that the sales that occur out of Atascadero, those contracts would be signed somewhere else?
Well, they would all be signed in the office in most cases.
Here.
Oh, yeah.
So the city would then gain that tax revenue.
That's my understanding, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And so do you have another representative that wishes to address the commission?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good evening, Chairman Vance, commissioners. My name is Eric Gobler. I'm a California licensed civil engineer, and I reside at 9110 Atascadero Avenue in Atascadero. I've had the pleasure of working with Macy Homes and Michael Fredericks on this project the last few months, and I've got a couple comments I'd like to make on the recommendations, but before I do that, I just want to let you know that we've worked very closely with city planning and public works staff, and in particular Mr. Athey and Mr. Castillo, the last few months, trying to make sure that we come up with a project that is easy to slide through the process and get approved. And I appreciate the hard work that the staff has put into helping us with that process. So thank you. I thought I had 4 comments that I was going to make, but based on discussions that we've had with the city during the last week and Mr. Castillo's presentation, I really only have 2. But I do want to say that we do support the removal of condition 21 through 35. We do believe that those have been completed. And with respect to, he didn't really mention this, but with respect to the ADA access, which is condition number 13, access to the sales area, I just want to clarify that it is now my understanding or our understanding that the existing all-weather surface that exists on site is considered acceptable access. So there's no additional access requirement that we have to make from the sales office to the display area. There are two conditions I would like to address specifically. The first is condition number 6, and this one incorporates by reference conditions of approval in the previously adopted CUP 2001-0043, and by reference it makes it clear that the portions of the previously approved project will remain, which is what the applicant and the owner would like
would like to see occur. 25 of the 38 conditions in the previous application or in the previous conditional use permit, I believe, have been completed. So the question then is, in reading this condition, how do we determine what? There we go. Okay. Do we need any language in that condition that makes it clear that we will be working with staff to resolve those, or is that understood? I would just suggest that maybe we could say something like, it is understood that many of the conditions in this CUP 2001-0043 have been met or do not apply to this project. The applicant will work with city staff to clarify which conditions remain. I don't know if something like that is necessary or not, but we do believe that most of the existing conditions have been met. And then with respect to condition number 10, it requires that a trash enclosure covered with wood or masonry be provided, and Mr. Castillo mentioned that in his staff report. This proposed project does not generate a lot of trash. There's no need for a dumpster. There might be a garbage can and a recycling can. I don't know what is envisioned for a trash enclosure, but if it just means that we have to screen a couple garbage cans, that's fine. The intent is that I don't think we need to build a big trash enclosure for the amount of trash that is going to be involved with the project. So if there's any change that's needed in the condition, we would encourage that. Otherwise, just know that there won't be a lot of waste that is generated by the project. In conclusion, I just want to say that if I understand the staff report correctly, we would like to encourage that you approve option 3, which would be use option 3, extending all previous entitlements, and then add the manufactured home as the proposed or the new option that, to the permit. So we would encourage you to approve condition number 3. And with that, I'd be happy to answer if there's any of the questions that you were discussing before. If I could answer those, I'd be happy.
Any questions from the commissioner? None?
Just real quick, I think it's in there. I remember seeing it, but the tie-ins for the water and sewer are going to go next door to the existing business?
No, the laterals for water and sewer are already in place at the street, so they'll be extended down to the office.
Oh, okay, I got you.
They're at the street.
Within the sales office?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? We're asked the audience if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to make a presentation on this matter. Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing, bring it back to the commission for further discussion and or a motion. Yes, Commissioner Colomarino.
Yes, I have a question for staff here. Staff has not taken a position with respect to any of the alternatives, but if we were to approve this what staff has the amendment that staff has recommended with the conditions that have been attached to that, we would then be we'd be approving under item number 6, condition number 6, we'd be approving these other uses. Is that not correct?
That's correct. We'd be approving the amendment to allow for the manufactured home use.
Yes, I have a comment, Alfredo. Actually, your recommendation that's up there on the screen incorporates option 3.
In, Not necessarily. It would be up to the commission to choose an option, whether even as a recommending option one, two, or three.
Well, when you allow for manufactured homes, that is option three.
The options are dealing with the future phases of the site.
Could you put the options back up?
Would sure.
I think just to clarify, the way staff has set it up, the resolution has option three already embedded in. So if you do nothing other than accept the resolution, then you will act on item three. So it'll take some amendment to the resolutions to do either one or two.
Okay.
Well, we would have to change condition six in particular.
Correct.
Yes, and I'd like to speak to that subject. In terms of these options, it seems to me that the point that staff has been making about the unforeseeability of the situation down the road 10 years in this area is a compelling point. If, you know, this business is here and goes along and remains in place for, let's say, 10 years with the manufactured housing business that it's talking about setting up here, and gets so big and is making so much money that it decides to move to some larger staging area. We hope that'll happen. And then this parcel becomes subject to development again, and if we do nothing, it can be used as mini storage. That might be a good thing, but in 10 years, it might not be something that is consistent with the neighborhood. I mean, hopefully, that'll be a very thriving business area, and there might be some better, higher use for that that premise. In any event, the conditional use is something that I think we should be able to look at again at that time. Also, it seems to me that there's something inconsistent about allowing for two uses when they can't be there at the same time. If this manufactured housing business is operating, it's going to be using the space that the mini storage business would need to operate, and it seems that there's something inappropriate, in my mind anyway, about allowing for two uses in an area that only permits one when these uses are conditional and at the discretion of the Planning Commission. So for those reasons, I think that we certainly should not be approving the continuation of the mini storage use. The office question is a little more difficult. In my mind, I find myself asking the question, should we leave it open for the owner to be able to build some offices, additional offices on this land in the area that's not being used by the manufactured housing business? But then again, I don't know the terms of the lease here. If the manufactured housing enterprise, if their lease covers the entire parcel, then I guess the owner would have to get their approval to do the additional offices there. I guess I should have asked the lessees representatives when they were here, but maybe we can get an answer to that. But in any event, for the owner to be able to do additional offices there, there may be some argument for that. I'm surprised, actually, that the owner is not here to tell us that this is something important to him. And because he's not, or because the representative of the owner, or no representative of the owner has made that point, I guess I'm less inclined to think that it matters and less inclined to provide for that opportunity.
Do we have any other comments from commissioners? Yes, Commissioner Devers.
On the three options that we have here, as current conditions allow for approving the project, either one for that matter, whichever, whether it's the mini storage or the sales yard. But in time, that may change, whether it be zoning or other reasons. I'm inclined to think that option three is appropriate, but with a sunset on it, which I would accept recommendations from the staff on what they think would be an appropriate timeline, because due diligence has been put into the project as it is to approve the projects, either one. But at a time, things will change. So to put a sunset on number three, I think is would be fine, and actually step it down even and say two is appropriate as well for a longer period of time. And after whatever agreed upon time, then we just revert all the way back to number one, and everything has to start from scratch. But the amount of time, I can't put a time on it. I think staff would know better as to what the potential for zoning changes would be, or just the complexity of that area of the city with respect to a project like this.
I'd like to make a comment. Let's see, how do I want to phrase this? I like option three because it keeps the land productive for whatever amount of time that is going to be there. It gives the property owner more options in which to continue to be business friendly in a community that wants to be business friendly. I think the it's really important for people to have options if they want to. At some point in time, we shouldn't be trying to keep the Planning Commission from changing the conditional use permit at some future time if they want to add a different use to the property, either through zoning or through a conditional use permit. They can bring it back to the council. So I think that we should give option three without any conditions. I think that's appropriate, and that would maintain keeping the property more likely to be in a producing positive state as opposed to falling in disrepair and blight. Yes, Commissioner Schmidt.
And, I tend to support where the direction you're going, but that is also at the very beginning why I talked about the appearance review group that we have set up. And having the appearance review group look at a future project doesn't take away the use, but it would deal with the subject of changes within the community. Whether the mini storage is there or not, depending on what's happening in the future, I've always kind of said we could build Disneyland anywhere, and so we could have a mini storage there that could fit the character of that area without taking away from it at the same time. And then ultimately, if mini storage isn't the highest and best use, I mean, if the owner of the property could put something else on the property that's going to get a better bang for his dollar, then he's certainly going to do that, and the mini storage and anything else is going to go away at that point. But I would like to ask questions of staff about, with the director, we were talking about this at the very beginning, and he was suggesting that we provide some direction for the appearance review group to have as guidelines. Would it be too vague to kind of work within the framework of the appearance review manual? So if the appearance review manual changes, then that would be dealt with at that point.
That might be a little on the vague side. I think, maybe you want to, if you limited it to colors and materials, that might be the best way to deal with it. Then based on community preferences about tile roofs or not tile roofs, that would be the opportunity to dial those in without getting into like the scale and massing and form that may unravel the whole project if you got into that. But colors and materials are fairly interchangeable. They do, the taste kind of change over time, and you can pretty much apply those to any building. So that might be a pretty safe thing to assign in the future for a DRC review.
Thank you. Does any of the commissioners have a comment about that approach?
Commissioner Colomarino.
I think that the concern about appearance is justified, but that's not where the concern ends, in my view. It goes beyond that because it is definitely foreseeable that there's change coming in that area, mm-hmm. and not just for aesthetic reasons, but fundamental business changes are going to take place in that area. So to me, I think it's better for the owner, who apparently doesn't find this so important enough to come and lobby us here tonight. I think it's enough for the owner to be able to allow this, go ahead with this use instead of the other use. And then in the future, if this business moves to another location, he can come back and seek a conditional use permit for some other use that's been identified and targeted at that time. And in those circumstances, it can be reviewed. He'll have another idea, probably. It probably won't be mini storage. He'll probably have some other thing. I mean, the mini storage thing came and went, it looks like. There'll be something else anyway, and I don't see the point, really, in allowing the mini storage opportunity, which has not been taken advantage of, to continue ad infinitum. It would seem to me that the best thing would be for him to come back, as he almost assuredly is going to have to do anyway, because mini storage will be is already a thing of the past for him. Come back and seek specific permission for another conditional use, and it can be reviewed at that time by the members of the Planning Commission, well, the Planning Department initially, and then Planning Commission in the circumstances that exist at that time, which we can all be pretty sure are going to be different than they are now. So with all that, I guess I'm saying I'm in favor of option one.
Commissioner Cooper.
Just out of curiosity, what is the estimated distance between this parcel and the, say, Del Rio interchange? I mean, I know that's a very general question. I drove that road several times this past week, but it seems to be about under a mile, I would say.
Yeah, it's about a mile, mile and a half probably. I think it's about 2 miles between San Anselmo and Del Rio interchange, and this is kind of about halfway in between.
Thank you. Just in regards to this discussion of, you know, where we're going in the very near future and what that end of town may look like, I agree with the applicant that manufactured homes sales is a great idea in this market, and we can see that even just with the 13 permits issued in the last year for new residential construction, and so I foresee them doing well there. And I think as the discussion on what the future holds for that parcel in particularly and the stuff that's going to be going on in the near proximity is an important one, certainly.
I favor option three just simply because it gives more options to a property owner that even if things change, and things will change because this community changes every day of the week, change will occur. And if they can adapt their property to different uses, which they can under option three, then I think we stand a better chance of having a productive piece of property for a longer period of time. And on that basis, I would support option three.
Make comment actually. Option three, it doesn't give, if I understand it correctly, it doesn't give any additional potential uses. It just reverts back to the mini storage. If the landowner wanted to do something completely different, basically they'd be going back to option one anyway. My feeling is that because the amount of time and effort put into it up to this point to approve both projects to be on the site. If the sales office should move to another location within a year, 5 years, whatever it is, to me it's pointless to go through the whole process again in that short amount of time. But there's going to come a time when zoning changes, the city changes, and things where it's not going to fit anymore, and it does need to be re-reviewed. And that's why I would think three is appropriate, but with a sunset where we would, you know, maybe skip two and go right down back up to number one. But I think use the effort that was put forth at one point, but put a sunset on it. It doesn't change anything as far as the owner goes, because they can come back tomorrow and apply for another CUP for a completely different project anyway.
Any other commissioners?
Yes.
Yeah. What is Commissioner Colomarino?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask staff about this sunset approach. That is something that is within our purview to include, right? A provision saying that the CUP for, as it applies to the mini storage business and the office business, that those uses that are permitted for a period of time and then that time expires. Is that correct?
Well, I think there's two ways, there's two answers to that question. I think what we've been told by city attorney in the past is that once a use is established, you can't sunset that. So like the cell tower, for example, you can't say, we can only do the cell tower for 10 years. Once it's there, it gets to go indefinitely.
I mean, once the use is actually being used.
Right. Exactly. Right. But in this case, we're talking about uses that haven't been established. So then I think you're really talking about phasing, that they have X number of years to establish that use. So I do believe you have discretion to put okay. that phasing on. The one caution I'll throw in as I'm thinking about this is, you know, Macy's Homes would like them to be there a long time. If you put some sort of time limit on when you have to build the mini storage, now all of a sudden you put pressure on the property owner to cut short potentially how long Macy's Homes is going to be there. So that could be the unintended consequence of doing that.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point.
I'd like to state that I believe the staff has made a good recommendation. I think they have a basis for that recommendation. And I would support the staff's position on the resolution that we have before us, which gives option three.
But for the record, staff has stated that they're not recommending any of those three options and leaving it up to us. I don't think staff has taken a position with respect to which of those options they're recommending we adopt. Is that not correct?
The way the conditions of approval have been written, condition number six, as Warren has stated before, does automatically assume that option three is the one because of it specifically states that calls out the mini storage and the office use.
Does that mean you're recommending it, that you're assuming it?
It's
because I understood you to say you weren't recommending anything, and I mean, I'm not trying to be funny here. I want to know what staff's position is, because that is relevant to me, and I am influenced by your point of view. So please tell me what your point of view is.
I think staff's recommendation is we don't see a problem with option three. Option three is built in automatically to the resolution that we're recommending approval of. But we did want to make sure that the commission understood what the range of options were. We're trying, you know, we've set it up so option three is the easiest thing for the commission to do, and we have no problem with option three. But we are trying to stay out of, you know, picking one of these. We think they're all, you know, equally valid, and we think it is just a commission discretion that you need to pick the best one.
So then you're neutral on them.
We're trying to be neutral on them.
Trying to be.
I wanted to comment also on
if. If you wanted to be neutral, why did you even put the option in there? And why did you preprint the resolution to pick option three? And why do the applicants specifically request option three?
They did do it, and we knew that we wanted to make sure, because adding something is always very difficult. So it's easier to extract or take something out of a resolution. So that's why we set it up so it was our... The most complicated thing to approve was already set up in there. We don't have any problem with option three. It does seem like there's a lot of good arguments for it, but we didn't specifically try to make a strong recommendation in the staff report is all we're saying. We have absolutely no problem with option three, and we've tried to write it so that option three is as easy as possible for the commission to adopt tonight.
So, Commissioner Smith.
Well, you know, we've talked about a lot about change, and change goes both ways too. We've been hopeful and optimistic about everything is going to be bright and glory and glorful in the future, and you know, who knows what's going to happen, but it could go the other way too at the same time, as we've seen in the last couple of years. And this is why I think there's at least a majority that is supporting the idea of trying to retain the existing use from the 03 approval. I mean, what happens if the sale, the manufactured home sales, doesn't function? Or what happens if there's a death in the family or something and it has to close down? I mean, things happen. And so we want to leave that option there in just in case it happens. But on the other side, I'm trying to understand what it is that is the concern about option three. When I talked about the Development Review Committee, the concern that I had is that, as was expressed by the director, is that there's an architectural style that's been approved for the mini storage and for the offices. And down the road, do we want that? Will that be compatible with that area or not? It might be. I don't know. I haven't seen it. But the idea of the Development Review Committee, for me, at least would provide some type of oversight in the future, and it would address that issue. I don't hear a majority from my fellow commissioners for that idea at this point, so I'll let it go at that.
I have an additional comment.
Yes, Commissioner Colomarino.
As I mentioned before, and as staff mentioned, what's going to happen in this area is not entirely foreseeable, although we know things are going to change. That's one consideration, and one, I think, very strong reason why I don't think we should have this additional use allowed. But the other thing is the idea of alternate conditional uses being permitted, I find it a little troubling. If an applicant came before us and said, okay, I want to apply for a conditional use permit that allows me to do A, and if that doesn't work out, B, and maybe another one, I think that would be considered very irregular and inappropriate, and we'd be disinclined to grant a permit for alternate conditional uses. And yet here we are saying that we're considering allowing this old use that has been neglected, has not been pursued, to continue to be permitted, and then to permit this new use. I just don't see it. There seems to be something wrong. The idea is there are allowed uses, and then there are conditional uses. And for a conditional use, you have to get approval. And that's what the way the zoning has been structured. There's a reason for that. The thought is that these uses are not known in advance to be consistent with the character of the neighborhood, and that they fit in so that they're designated an allowed use and they're permitted without any need to come to the Planning Commission for approval. So there is a need to come and get approval for these conditional uses. One has been granted. It hasn't been acted upon. Now, for the same property, we're talking about granting a second one. It seems to me that means we should get rid of the first one so that we don't have alternate uses sitting out there.
I agree mostly in part with Commissioner Colomarino, what you're saying.
dual uses is seems to be a little bit contradictory. But getting to the back to the sunset issue on the previous conditional use permit, I don't believe that because there would be a sunset on it that it would cause the owner to hurry up and want to revert back to that use that he had already applied for, because all he has to do is reapply for it again should the sunset go beyond. If a 10-year limit was placed on it and the sales yard was still functioning fine, then it just goes away, and if another 5 years goes by, he just reapplies for a new CUP. If it was within that time, then it would just expedite the alternate use to the property. But I don't think it's going to hurry up and say you got to move your yard because we're running out of time for the mini storage. I just don't see that it's happening like that.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Yeah, we started the discussion at the beginning, and there was some questions about the CEQA document. And in terms of the two uses, what has been identified by staff is that both uses fall within the mitigated neg deck that was issued in 2003. My question has to do with the future, though. And if there are changes in the environment, and say 10 years down the road, will the CEQA document still be valid if there are significant changes that occur within the next 5 to 10 years?
Yes, CEQA document's going to remain valid for the life of the project. What's going to happen is new projects around there will have to take into account this project and accommodate it. But the big issue typically with commercial projects is the traffic impacts, and both the mini storage and the sales lots are both very low traffic generators, and that's why we're recommending that this project's consistent with the original CEQA determination. They both generate about the same number of trips, which is fairly low. And then the site impacts are very similar. They both end up with a totally impervious site that is basically just all, development, whether it's roofs on mini storage or, flat lot for sale. So they end up having basically the same impacts either way. And that would allow us to issue permits for the mini storage anytime in the future based on the determination that's already been made.
Are there any fees that the city has that are tied to the conditional use permit, and so there would be a benefit to the property owner that if we retain the existing entitlement and he builds it 15 years down the road, fee structure changes over that period of time, either higher or lower, would he be locked in to the fees that are in place in 2003?
No, the fees are going to be assessed as part of the building permit, and those fees are based on the date of building permit application. So if he applies for a mini storage 10 years from now, he'll pay the building permit fees that are established 10 years from now.
Okay, thank you.
I have an indication from an audience member that he would like to speak, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing and ask Richard Shannon to address the commission.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm Richard Shannon. I'm a real estate agent. I represent Michael Fredericks in the property, and he couldn't be here tonight. He was feeling a little under the weather. But if you could put the picture back up there of the site plan, maybe I could help out a little bit on these options, 1, 2, and 3. Okay. On the upper right-hand corner of the property there, you can see where the cell tower is, and then right directly in front of that is a phase for a future office building, right there, yes. And that's actually a separate parcel. And so the parcel, that particular parcel is not being leased to Macy Homes. The balance of the site is being leased to Macy Homes. And Michael Fredericks, I know that one of the reasons he wants option 3 is that option, he spent a lot of time and money and going through all the environmental processes, all the approval processes. And option 3 enables him to, if the economics allow him to build that office building under the existing CEQA without having to go back and redo everything, which he feels is correct. I could tell you that currently the economic situation is not good for building mini storage, so he has no intention of building a mini storage at this time. But on the other hand, he feels the same thing about the mini storage, that he would like to keep that option open in the future. Things might change, and he might want to build it someday. He also is very aware that the Walmart Center is being processed up the street, and we've had many conversations about that this may not be a good spot for a mini storage, and if it isn't, I can tell you that economics will dictate that, and mini storage wouldn't be built. But he feels like he's gone through the process. He's already done his CEQA. He's already done all the environmental. And he really wants to keep his option open for that office building. And that's where his position is at this time. And that is a separate parcel. It's not part of what Macy is leasing. And so if you choose option one, you'd be wiping out his ability to build an office building on that property without having to go back through a whole process again.
As far as the parking goes, is that lot that has the office on it, can it support the parking for that office building, or is it dependent on the mobile home lease site for parking?
Well, there's reciprocal easements throughout that property, and the parking would occur throughout the reciprocal easements.
So the office building can't stand on its own without the parking, easement.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It may be a 4,000-foot office couldn't, but you could build a smaller one and park it there on its own. So there's several things available to him at this time. And this is a very, very tough economic time for everybody. I don't have to tell everybody that. And what the property owner is doing a temporary lease to Macy Homes, in which we hope they are there for many, many years and are successful. But he wants to keep his options open in case things don't work out. He doesn't want to give up all of his rights that he's already established.
Any other questions? Commissioner Colomarino, please.
First of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Shannon, for providing this information. It answers a question that I was raising before about the lease and what it covers. And so as you explained, the manufactured housing business does not get the whole parcel, but rather the parcel that does not include the area that had been designated for offices. Is that right?
Well, I think there may be two. I'm not sure if I can see your building correctly there. There may be, if you wanted to, I could give you a map showing you what property they get. I actually brought it with me. But if you go back to that aerial that was just on there, that one shows it right there. See the yellow line right there?
Yes.
That's the property boundary line. And so they would be getting, they get everything at this side of that yellow line, correct? And all the way up to El Camino Real, but not including that little area there, which is part of an easement area.
And that would be the area that he wants to build offices on?
Yes, it would either, and where it's designed to go is right there where he's pointing that arrow at right now.
Yes. And now option two would allow him to do that, build those offices, as I understand it.
Yes, it would.
Option two, right.
Yes. So, and we've had some conversations about possibly selling the property to the owners, to the modular of people, too. So, this could all be moot, but on the other hand, it's like back to where we get to is this is a terrible economic time for everybody, and property owners want to keep their options open. And they feel, and rightly so, they feel they've already paid for that right. They've already done all those things.
Well, he didn't establish the use, though, that he came and sought permission.
You're right. He hasn't established the use yet. You're right. Do you have any other questions?
If that ends your presentation, then I'll close the public hearing and bring it back to the commission for further discussion and or a motion. Any more discussions? Someone want to take a stab at trying to make a motion for their favorite case?
I guess what I favor is option two, and I would be willing to make a motion to approve the amended conditional use permit subject to option two, and I'm trying to think about how that would come out with respect to condition six. I guess that would involve saying that condition six should be amended to permit only changing 6A to say that the office use permitted under the original CUP is continued. Only the office use is continued.
Yeah, I think if you went to the subsequent page, page 54, that's where phase four, the mini storage, is listed. So you would be recommending dropping that phase four.
I see.
And then you would also amend exhibit B1, which was on page 58, and also eliminate phase four from the exhibit.
You would eliminate exhibit, phase four from exhibit B1. I see. All right, so based on that, I move that we approve an amendment to conditional use permit 2001-0043 to allow a manufactured home sales lot within the commercial park zone at APN 049-201-048, 2850 El Camino Real, Frederick, with a change to condition six, eliminating the phase four clause under subsection 6A, and changing exhibit B1 to eliminate the phase four mini storage reference.
And just to clarify, staff's also recommending dropping conditions 21 through 35.
Yes, and that's... Is that in here already?
No, you have to add that.
Okay, so consider that added. And may I ask for a second?
In the fails 2 to 3, so...
I'd like to make a second motion, please, that the Planning Commission adopt Resolution PC 2011-0002, approving an amendment to the conditional use permit 2001-0043 based on the findings and subject to the conditions of approval, including the changes that staff has recommended to eliminate conditions 21 through 35.
Is there a second?
I second.
Roll call.
Commissioner Calamarino.
Yes.
Commissioner Cooper.
Yes.
Commissioner Drez.
I'm sorry, to get clarification. Was there an option? Which option did you?
That would include option three, which is already embedded in the resolution.
At this time, I'm going to say no.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, and on this subject, staff has put a lot of time into this application and has worked with the applicant. They seem satisfied that this could work.
Finish the roll call.
I believe we've hashed this out, and so for that reason, I'm going to support it.
That was a yes?
Yes, it is.
Commissioner Benz?
Yes.
Motion passes 4-1.
All right. We will move on to item four, the Planning Commission study session, CEQA EIR study session.
All right. Thank you. So this is basically a follow-up to the presentation that Alfredo and Callie gave at the last meeting. So at the last meeting, we talked about the general plan and how that worked, and we talked about the zoning ordinance and kind of how that worked. So the next big part of planning is the CEQA process, and we just talked about it quite a bit tonight. So what we want to do tonight is just kind of walk you through kind of how CEQA is organized, how it's supposed to work, what the different terminology is, and kind of provide an opportunity for the commission to ask questions. So if I say something that doesn't make sense or something comes to mind, please just, jump in and ask a question. So to begin with, we use the term CEQA a lot. So what does that stand for? What stands for the California Environmental Quality Act? It was adopted in the early 1970s, right after the NEPA Act, which was a federal law that applies to federal projects. A lot of people get confused about what the purpose of CEQA is. I think the key thing to remember about CEQA is it really was a sunshine law. It was supposed to provide the public with information about development projects. So if you keep that in mind, then CEQA seems to make more sense, because CEQA doesn't actually make a decision on the project and doesn't tell you what to do on a project. What CEQA is supposed to do is disclose to the decision makers and the public what the potential environmental effects of a project are. So it's a disclosure document. That's why it has all these public review processes built into it, where that impact is. So in terms of the CEQA process, basically it is a process. And the first thing to do is to determine if something's actually going to be subject to CEQA. And actually, the planners spend a lot of time working on CEQA determinations that never come before the Planning Commission, actually don't ever turn anything more than just a exemption of one sort or another. So typically, if you see down there on the bottom, we kind of have the laundry list of the different levels. So most of the projects that come through community development, like building permits, are determined to be ministerial or exempt, and they basically, the CEQA process stops right there for them. Projects that are still subject to CEQA that aren't exempt typically go then through the negative declaration process. So something like a conditional use permit or a subdivision map typically has a negative declaration process. But what happens is as we go through the negative declaration process, typically we find there's some sort of impact, either a traffic issue or an air quality issue or a grading issue that needs some sort of mitigation. So we hardly ever actually issue what's called a negative declaration. Almost always what we have is a mitigated negative declaration, which is where you've gone through the process, identified some sort of impacts, and you have to mitigate those. So the mitigated negative declaration is really, I guess, what they call the workhorse of CEQA right now. Most projects that go through the mitigated negative declaration process, and that's gotten more and more robust, where you see actually very thick and significant mitigated negative declarations that are probably more thorough than EIRs were, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. But that is the process that we at a staff level take care of quite a bit. Those are typically what comes before the Planning Commission. And then the final type of CEQA document would be the EIR, or the Environmental Impact Report. And that's where we're required to look at all the issues in detail, study alternatives, study cumulative impacts, as a more thorough public review process. And just due to all those sorts of issues, they tend to be fairly comprehensive and time-consuming documents. And staff doesn't prepare EIRs internally. Those are contracted out. That's really become a specialty industry, is the preparation of EIRs. And that's what we're seeing on the Walmart project that we're working on right now. So this little table here, it doesn't read real well, but this kind of shows the checklist of how you get through the CEQA process. So you start at the top and try to figure out if your project is subject to CEQA or not. And as you move down, you try to get out of CEQA as soon as possible, is really the way it works. So if you're not exempt, then you try to come up with an exemption of some sort. If you can't get an exemption, then you go through the mitigated negative declaration. If you still have significant impacts, finally that kicks you down into the EIR process. So we'll use the term project quite a bit, because that's actually reasonably foreseeable impacts that could result from the project to the environment. And then the whole question of what's an impact to the environment has kind of morphed and changed. And a good example of this is the issue of economic impact. And we'll see this, and we'll talk about this on the Walmart project. economic impact is not actually an environmental impact, and that's not what we're going to be analyzing in the Walmart project, because that's not a physical impact. But the results of economic decay could create a physical impact. So blight, or abandoned stores that gather graffiti and cause crime and that sort of thing, that is an environmental impact. So on the Walmart project, for example, what we have to look at is, does that project have the potential to create urban decay or blight somewhere else? And it could if it had an economic impact that was significant on other property. So that's kind of how you get to some of these issues. But it has to be an environmental impact. Another one is parking. Parking actually used to be in the CEQA checklist as something we looked at. And the courts have looked at that and decided that parking, the lack of parking, actually is not an environmental impact. So parking's no longer in the CEQA checklist. But if you had to build a parking structure because of a project, then the construction of a parking structure or parking lot could be an environmental impact. But you've got to be building something or physically changing something physical to actually be an impact. So projects are typically subject to CEQA when they are discretionary, which means there's some sort of level of judgment or discretion that either happens at a staff level or a commission or council level. So pretty much anything that comes before the commission or council is going to have some discretion and automatically is a trigger for CEQA, unless it has some sort of exemption that's already in the statutes. Many of the projects, though, that come before staff aren't discretionary. So the building permits are ministerial acts, and those are not subject to CEQA. It's only if there's some sort of discretion. So some of the projects may require some sort of grading review or some sort of design review. Then they become discretionary at that point. So up here, some projects that are exempt would be the ministerial projects, like just a strict building permit's exempt. Emergencies are exempt. If you reject or disapprove a project, those actually don't require, you don't have to do CEQA to reject a project. Setting fees and rate changes, that sort of thing, don't require CEQA as well. So typically the projects at staff level that are exempt, we issue what's called a categorical exemption. If you go ahead, Lynn.
I would just want to ask a quick question here. Could you give me an example of an emergency project that would be exempt from CEQA?
Yeah, like tearing down an old building downtown after a fire, which happens with Nunes Auto Body.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So categorical exemptions, those typically happen at a staff level. You don't see those, but if you actually look at the statute books for CEQA, I think now there's 33 categories satisfy that need. And we use the term CEQA document sometimes just to describe generically that we have to comply with CEQA, because we don't know if it's going to be an EIR or a categorical exemption. All those final documents that you file are all called the same thing, which is the CEQA document. Dennis.
There are legislative exemptions, too, are there not? I mean, like the 1984 Olympics, I think, in Los Angeles was exempt from the CEQA process by the people up in Sacramento.
Yeah, there's a categorical exemptions. There's also a series of statutory exemptions. And then there's also a series of just exempt exemptions. And because CEQA is now almost 40 years old, things have gathered. So it's at... It actually takes some work now to try to figure out where all the exemptions are squirreled away in there.
I had heard that, and I don't know if it was ever achieved, but the football stadium down in the City of Commerce, I think, was the people who were trying to make that exempt, too.
That was officially exempt by Governor Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. you were having a discussion about thresholds of impacts. There... to my understanding, there isn't a blanket of what is significant or what is less than significant, and that each agency can basically establish their own thresholds.
Yeah, the CEQA actually encourages agencies to set their own threshold standards so that there's some consistency within the agency. For example, like in our general plan, we set the level of service for an intersection operation at level of service C. And so when you drop below C down into D, that would be the threshold of significance, and that's what we're using currently on EIRs, is to see if we have any interchanges or intersections that drop below D, and at that point, then that triggers mitigation.
I guess I was getting at it as something that might be significant in the city of Monterey, if the impact might be less than significant in Oxnard.
Correct.
And so there isn't this kind of, when people come in and say, well, it's, you know, somewhere else, it was this, why aren't you doing the same thing?
Right. I think like oak tree removals is a good example. In Atascadero, we're probably more permissive with oak tree removals just because we have so many oak trees than you may, you know, be in LA or Thousand Oaks at this point. It's just a different community standard.
Yeah. And I didn't, and at the very beginning you were talking about the alternative discussion. The CEQA, the statute, does it define what an alternative has to achieve? For instance, when you have a project description, you'll have objectives that you write into your project description. Doesn't the alternative have to meet the objectives of the project? It just can't be anything as an alternative.
Well, there's a range of alternatives. You know, one alternative that you have to study is
no
project
alternative.
So you have to do that. But the other alternatives have to be feasible. So there has to be some possibility of doing them, and they also have to reduce the impact from whatever the project is. So that gives you, you know, some sort of range. So proposing something that's totally inconsistent with what the applicant's project is would potentially make it infeasible, and therefore that wouldn't be a valid alternative. Do a series of different sections like aesthetics, air quality, traffic, biology, and then under each one of those sections, there's usually a series of 5 to 6 questions, and under each one of those questions, you have to go through, or staff has to go through and check the boxes. So the, like, this would be the first question here, and then there'd be 4 boxes. So this box would be no impact. This box would be less than significant impact. This box would be less than significant impact with mitigation measure, and this would be significant impact. So if you always just check this box, you just end up with a neg deck. If you need any mitigation measures because you checked this box, now you're doing a mitigated negative declaration. And if for whatever reason you end up having to check this box, which is significant impact that you can't mitigate, that's your trigger for an EIR. So you actually do this checklist to determine whether you're going to do a neg deck or an EIR. And as you go through this, you have to explain your answers and then start to do your mitigation measures. Typically, this is the majority of the form that's part of the mitigated negative declaration, and that's what you'll see attached in your staff report for your reference, because when you're approving a project, we're going to ask you to certify the environmental determination, and that's based on these 40 pages of checklist. So I know a lot of times you look at your staff report and go, why is there so much paper and all that sort of thing? Well, you are responsible for reviewing and certifying that, so you need all that background information to make that decision. That's why it's in your staff reports. Lynn?
So you and the planning department fill out this form? Is that
all the time?
And so then CEQA is only triggered when you check any of the boxes on the far left, right?
Well, you're always in CEQA, basically.
Right.
Any projects,
an EIR, I'm sorry.
Yeah, an EIR is triggered by these boxes here. Neg decks are these boxes here.
And when you check one of those boxes on the left, it's because you believe that there is a substantial or significant impact that can't be mitigated?
Yeah, it's so called a significant unavoidable impact. So
unavoidable. So that's your preliminary conclusion already, then, is that this EIR is going to result in an unmitigable impact, huh?
Yeah, typically.
And so let's take something such as the Walmart project, which is a really large project. I take it you went through this process and you ended up checking some of those boxes?
Yeah, the EIR consultant went through that process and determined right off the bat very easily that due to the level of traffic impacts and air quality impacts associated with traffic, that there were going to be unresolved significant issues and that you were automatically going to be into an EIR process.
But do EIRs ever result in a finding that there are no impacts that can't be mitigated?
They can. Sometimes you'll get into it, and as you do all the technical studies, what you thought might have been significant, unavoidable, maybe in the end you find out that you can avoid it. Those are called the class one impacts, which are the significant unavoidables. You try to, you know, minimize those to the extent possible, but typically the reason you were in an EIR is because there was one or
two. Warrant an EIR if there's enough outcry out there. Typically, if Fish and Game or, you know, some of the other agencies say that there's, you know, something there that it's safe to go down the EIR path because of those comments, because of those statements. Is that somewhat accurate?
Well, it used to be true.
Okay.
But they changed that. So when CEQA first came out, it did say that one of the triggers for an EIR was public controversy, and that so opened up the ability to challenge any project.
It has to
project.
Be substantiated now is the difference.
Yeah. Nowadays, yeah. They took that language out, and now it has to be substantial evidence by some sort of knowledgeable professional. So, you know, if somebody's going to raise a substantial traffic issue, they have to have some sort of, you know, traffic knowledge or engineering to be able to raise that. Just, you know, a neighborhood coming up and say, oh, the traffic's going to be awful, doesn't pass the test anymore.
Yeah, it's not difficult though to make those statements and create that situation. I mean, you do have to have some substantial evidence to show that it's there. But you know, generally a discussion, like I said, if it was Caltrans who makes the comment on it, it's hard to say they're wrong.
Right. Well, and that would be treated different because obviously they'd be the expert. So if Caltrans raises a significant traffic issue, then you definitely need to determine if you can mitigate that or not. And if you can't, then that would be an EIR trigger.
Okay, thank you.
Lynn? Another question I had is whether staff uses a different standard in determining whether something can be mitigated than the EIR consultant would use. In other words, can staff say traffic impact can be mitigated by having a new interchange built off the, or an adjustments made to the interchange off the freeway? Can you specify that, or and what about the EIR consultant? They can, I guess, say they can come up with any idea, I suppose, to try to mitigate something. Is that?
Well, we're basically should be using the same thresholds and standards. Typically what happens is staff's dealing with much smaller projects, so a smaller project's a lot easier to mitigate. So the traffic from a, you know, 12,000 square foot store, you know, maybe is just, you know, some lanes and organizing the driveways and you've addressed the mitigation. Whereas if you're doing a 250,000 square foot shopping center, then you're talking about new interchanges and new signals and all that sort of thing. So the mitigation's a lot more complicated. But typically, both would rely on some sort of traffic study. So even small projects, we typically will get a very quick traffic study done by a traffic engineer that will lay out, you know, what the issues are and how to mitigate them. And if you're doing an EIR, then you have a very lengthy traffic study. But traffic tends to be one of those issues that shows up on most commercial projects. And a lot of times we do have some sort of traffic consultant retained to help out with that process, whether it's a NEGDEC or an EIR.
But staff has to participate in reviewing every large project, too, right? I mean, it can't go for EIR until staff says that there's something, that a substantial impact that can't be mitigated.
Right. And even with the EIR consultant is working for the city. So they're basically the environmental setting, which is pretty much everything around the project, the existing traffic conditions, the existing development patterns, what's on the site, are there different biological communities, is it flat, is it steep, that sort of thing. And then we'll list, you know, what the potential impacts are and then the mitigation measures, as we mentioned. So let's see. As I mentioned, with the initial study, there's three basic decisions that come out of the initial study, which is everything doesn't require mitigation, which is a negative declaration, or you can deal with it with mitigation measures, and then you have the mitigated negative declaration. Or if you have the significant impact, then that's your trigger for for the EIR. So when you get into an EIR, that is, as I mentioned, because you have some sort of significant impacts that can't be mitigated. It is a very time-consuming process just because EIRs have become so lengthy at this point. Typically, they take about 1 to 2 years. I think this Walmart EIR, we let the contract for that last May, so that one's going to take almost exactly a year to finish up. So they tend to be something we don't do often, but they're out there. And then just to, you know, remind everybody, you know, like I said, the purpose, you know, is to provide the information to the decision makers and the public about the project. So in terms of what you'll find in an EIR typically, there's usually an initial study that identifies what the potential environmental impacts are. You have your notice of preparation. Actually, this is the process. Notice of preparation. After that's issued, we go through the administrative draft EIR, which is an internal review of the EIR. After that's completed, we issue the draft EIR, which is the public review version. There's a 45-day review on that, which is what we're in the middle of on the Walmart project. Once the public review period's closed, we'll have collected a series of comments from the public. We're going to have to respond in writing to all those comments. So the draft EIR plus the comments plus the responses to the comments create what's called the final EIR. So the draft EIR is kind of confusing. People think it's a draft that then you're going to, like, rewrite the thing. Well, you really don't. The draft EIR stays as is, and you add more pieces to it, and that's how you get to the final EIR. And as you respond to the comments, that may create changes in certain conclusions or parts of the draft EIR, but the draft EIR will basically stay the same. So then what ends up happening for public hearings is we'll have the final EIR, plus we'll have what's called the mitigation monitoring plan, which is all the mitigation measures that are in the draft EIR with a program for how you're going to implement them. It basically will assign responsibilities and timings to those mitigation measures, because that was one of the things they found early with the EIRs is everybody did these mitigation measures and then they forgot about them. So mitigation monitoring plan ensures that there is a monitoring and follow-up to make sure they happen. And then with the adoption, because...
Statement of overriding considerations?
That'll all be done by the consultant.
And is it a given that, that's going to be done? Or does the consultant sometimes conclude that there are not overriding considerations?
Well, if you have any remaining Class 1 impacts, which are significant and unavoidable at the end of the process, then you have to have a statement of overriding considerations to certify the EIR. So the only way to approve the project at the end of the day, if you have a Class 1 impact, is with a statement of overriding considerations. And you have to have the statement and findings for each one of the impacts. So basically for each impact, there'll be this full discussion of what the issues are, why you can't resolve it, and whatever the overriding benefit to the community would be for still accepting the project.
But my question is, does the consultant or the staff ever conclude that there are not overriding considerations to justify going, accepting these impacts? And then I guess if they did that, that would mean it doesn't get proposed to the city council?
Yeah, and that wouldn't be staff's role, because that's the council's policy decision. So staff's role and the consultant's role is to prepare the decision for the decision makers. So the decision makers then, they have to weigh that. They don't have to accept the statement of overriding considerations. They could say, you know what, the impacts are too great. We won't move forward with the project. And that's really what CEQA was meant to do. But staff shouldn't be making that decision. Our job is just to prepare the information so that the decision makers can make the most informed decision possible.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to me it should be called a statement of countervailing considerations, and then the council could decide whether they amount to, whether they override. But anyway, I get it.
So typically your EIR is going to be organized in the following manner. There'll be an executive summary that outlines what the conclusions of the EIR are. There's the project description that describes what the project is. There's the impact analysis, which ends up being the majority of the document, which goes through, like the initial study, but in much, much greater detail, looking at issues like traffic and air quality, identifying what the issues are, identifying what the thresholds of significance are, identifying what the impacts are, and then explaining what the potential range of mitigation measures are, and then identifying what the potential remaining impact is. So sometimes you'll go through all this analysis, put all these mitigation measures on, and still at the end it'll say significant issue. So I think as you're reading EIRs, you'll kind of see that that's the organization. Also keep in mind with EIRs, some people read EIRs and they go, well, you know, they kind of, you know, or they don't take a strong position. They're not saying this is good or bad. They're just kind of, you know, monotone about things. Well, that's the purpose. They aren't trying to take a position. They're just trying to provide the information in a kind of a neutral, objective fashion. So you won't say, you know, they'll talk about traffic impacts and they won't say they're really bad or they're not that big a deal. They'll try not to use any of that sort of terminology. They'll just say this is level of service B, this is level of service C. I mean, it's kind of boring, but that's it's supposed to be
standard. Are there any professional standards that consultants have to satisfy with respect to impartiality, neutrality, objectivity?
You know, there's no, I think, official standards, but the best EIR firms, I think, do work at a very high level. And I think what's happened is over the years, the courts have continually struck down and thrown out the EIRs that weren't professional and objective. And I think that's kind of what's eventually set the standard. So the firms that have been around a long time are very good at writing these, and they've been through enough, you know, litigation on these that I think out of that process there's become a way of doing these that's accepted as the way to do them. But it doesn't really say that in CEQA exactly how best to write one of these, but I think it's evolved over time.
I take it you're going to get to the subject of what makes an EIR vulnerable to attack in court?
No, I wasn't.
You weren't?
Mistakes. So impact analysis, that ends up being the majority of the EIR in terms of just pages. Cumulative effect analysis, that's toward the end, the conclusion, where they try to wrap up what the long-term effects of all the impacts together might be on a project. Then the alternatives analysis, this is where they look at, you know, feasible options that would reduce the impacts that are identified in a project. So if the project had a traffic impact that was significant, you know, the alternative would look at how to reduce the traffic, whether make it the project smaller or maybe move some of the driveways around or that sort of thing. A lot of times, though, nowadays there's so much work put in ahead of time on projects that these projects are fairly well designed ahead of time. You know, these applicants are working with traffic engineers and professionals early on, so usually don't come up with, you know, like, oh, you guys, duh, you should have thought of this. You know, they usually have these projects pretty well dialed in by the time they get to an EIR process. And then there's some other considerations, random stuff you find at the end. And then the appendices are typically the technical studies that were used to create the impact analysis. So there'll be a section in impact analysis that's the traffic analysis, which may be, say, 100 pages long, but that's based on a 500-page technical traffic report that's included in the appendices. So when you're reading the EIR, there's usually, you know, something twice as big that's called the appendices that has all the air quality calculations, all the noise model runs, all the traffic model runs, all that really detailed stuff. And as planning commissioners, you're not required to read or know all that sort of stuff. But we have to provide that because if there's a question about something, we have to be able to justify and show how these conclusions were reached. Here's some examples just out of the EIR. This is out of the executive summary. So you'll see typically there's a column that identifies the different section. This is cultural resources, and then they'll identify impacts, and typically they'll all discussion of the impact, the mitigation measures, and that sort of thing. So public participation is a major part of CEQA. As I mentioned, CEQA is a disclosure document. It's intended to provide the public with information. The negative declarations and the mitigated negative declarations have a 20-day review period. So we have to post all the contiguous lots around a site that this is available for public review. We also send out letters, and then it's available for 20 days. So it's at the front counter. We also take it over to the county recorder, and it's posted over there, and we post it online. So everybody has 20 days to comment on it. EIRs have a 45-day review period, a little bit longer, but they have the same basic noticing requirements. Like I said, it's all about allowing the public the opportunity to comment. In terms of how these different documents are approved, staff actually approves quite a few negative declarations. Those go under what's called a precise plan process. So a lot of the hillside grading projects and smaller commercial projects have a staff level review where staff actually makes the final decision and certifies negative declarations. And those are the precise plans. Planning Commission, you typically end up being the final say on conditional use permits and tentative maps, and then you would do the certification. And then the City Council ends up having the final say on certifying general plan amendments and zoning amendments. And a lot of times a general plan or a zoning amendment will also include a CUP and a map. So whatever the most superior decision is, then all these will carry along. So some of these will go through Commission and Council. Any decisions that staff makes can be appealed to the Planning Commission, and then any decisions the Planning Commission makes can be appealed to the City Council. City Council decisions are final, though. There's no appeal of a City Council decision, so the only remedy there would be litigation, which is always a potential on CEQA projects. So that'll conclude this little staff discussion. Any questions, anything I missed?
Can litigation be based on mistakes made by the Planning Commission?
Yeah, I think any mistakes anywhere in the process are always one of the first things that are challenged if there's going to be litigation. The courts aren't going to question, you know, whether the council made the right decision approving a project. It's always about the process correct? So was the noticing right? Was the project description right? Did all the analysis make sense? Did these things, they're looking for mistakes. So if somebody said or did something incorrectly, that's the kind of thing that these attorneys likely are going to glom onto.
And there would have to be evidence to support findings that are made, I assume, by the Planning Commission and the City Council. There have to be adequate evidence to support those?
Well, there have to be findings. I think a lot of times, you know, the courts aren't going to determine whether you had enough evidence. They just want to make sure that there was something.
Some evidence.
Yeah, that there was findings that you made.
Mm-hmm.
So in regards to that, I mean, that
the commission makes happens at the meeting, and that going into the meeting, everyone is of an open mind, and that you're waiting for the meeting to get your evidence, hear from the public, and make your decision. So you wouldn't want to say something or do something in public ahead of that meeting that would somehow imply that you've made up your mind and that you're no longer open to what the public's going to have to say or evidence that, you know, might come up or deliberations that may have. So the best thing is to, you know, listen to everybody and take everything under consideration and keep your mind open until we get to making a motion. That's when you should then make your decision.
And I guess that applies to pretty much everything we do, right, as a quasi-administrative agency.
Yeah, it's a good rule of thumb for actually everything, and it'll keep you out of hot water in a lot of other cases.
The best thing you can do is to say you haven't made up your mind until you hear all the information. And then when it comes back and you close the public hearing and it's back here for debate and discussion, and a motion, that's when you make up your mind. Don't do it before then. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, you done with your report?
I am.
Okay, how about commissioner comments and reports? Anything from the commissioners? None? Hearing none? How about the director's report? Or did you just give it?
No, I still have more stuff for you. Okay, so your next meeting looks like it's on March 1st. Do we have anything queued up yet, Alfredo?
I don't believe so at this time, but you never know when a random tree might fall down in town, especially with it raining in the next few days.
Another conditional use permit?
Potentially.
So we'll see if we have anything for that meeting. If not, then we may just do, you know, some more training, that sort of thing. But I'm planning on having a meeting either way. In terms of project updates, as we've talked, the Walmart EIR is out for public review right now. It's under the 45-day review process. Closing date is March 18th on that. The Galaxy Theater, if you got here earlier tonight, you'll have seen that most of the signage is up on the marquee. The stars are up. They're scheduled to be open on March 5th for the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival, which actually will be holding a number of events in the theater. So staff-wise, we're working really closely with the architect and the construction team to make sure that thing's ready to open. But it's on track, and it's looking good. So we're happy about that. The Eagle Ranch project, we're still working with the applicant and the EIR consultant on getting the EIR going on that. It's probably looking like April, I'm guessing, that we'll be starting to roll into some sort of public participation and study sessions on that project. And then the Hoff project, the La Plaza project, I don't know if I mentioned that before, but that application was withdrawn by Mr. Wysong. I think there was a story that ran in the paper, I think today, actually, on that. But right now, that second theater is no longer proposed, and we're working with the Hoff family on an alternate project of some sort, and we're not exactly sure what that's going to be at this point, but they do have a new design team and a new developer working on that, so that is starting to move forward at this point.
Anything on Tractor Supply?
There hasn't been any formal action on any of the other parcels. That we, at a staff level, had some discussions with some of the neighboring property owners. I think there's general agreement that everybody wants to do some sort of project. It's just a matter of trying to figure out what that is and then working out all the arrangements for getting everybody involved in it. So that usually takes quite a bit of time and effort to figure out those sorts of details, but that is one of the priorities that the council's identified, and staff's going to be spending quite a bit of time working on that this year.
But there's no common ownership at this point, those properties. However, there is some organization of the owners of them.
I think there's kind of a common interest, I guess, among all the owners to do something different. I mean, a lot of the properties are, you know, kind of vacated at this point or kind of antiquated at this point. So I think everybody is interested in doing something new, but what that something is will take some time to figure out.
Okay. That being it, I will adjourn this meeting to our next regularly scheduled meeting on March 1st if Warren doesn't cancel it before. Thank you.